the fighting with Palestinian resistance fighters on the ground in the Gaza Strip. An Israeli media report says 3 troopers were killed and 11 others injured in an ambush carried out in the Al-Mughawraka district by the Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of the Hamas movement. Al-Qassam has also announced a group of Israeli soldiers were trapped in a minefield the Palestinians had planted using unexploded munitions dropped on Gaza. Reports say that Palestinian fighters are putting stiff resistance to invading Israeli forces and continue to inflict heavy losses on them. The Israeli military has so far confirmed some 260 deaths amongst its troops since the launch of a ground invasion of Gaza. But Palestinians and some mainstream media say the regime is hiding the actual number to avoid Israeli public anger. The senior Hamas official says the Palestinian resistance movement is serious about reaching a Gaza ceasefire agreement, but it will not bow down to US pressure. Sami Abu Zuhri was referring to Israel's counter-proposal on a Gaza deal. He underlined that any agreement that fails to include an end to the Israeli aggression will be unacceptable. In a separate statement, a Hamas spokesman rejected reports that the movement has agreed on the expulsion of some of its leaders from Gaza, saying they will remain there with Palestinian citizens. Jihatar said those who will be compelled to leave the region are, in his words, Nazi occupiers. On Saturday, Hamas announced that it had received Israel's response to a proposal offered 2 weeks ago by the resistance group. Hamas says any deal must guarantee a permanent ceasefire, in addition to the return of the displaced Palestinians and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. Earlier, we discussed the topic with Isabella Zeidan, researcher at Damascus University in Syria. She said all Israel has wanted since establishment was killing more Palestinians and seizing more lands. Let's take a listen.
Ever since the launch of the temporary entity of Israel, we had this lie, like, do the ceasefire and we will give the Palestinians what they want. What happens next is killing more Palestinians. If this kind of deal would reach the Palestinians or would get the Palestinians to the safe side, it would have happened long time ago, not this time. Mm-hmm. And we all know when it started, definitely before October the 7th. All they want is just drag this region into, first of all, the president of the so-called prime minister of what is called the Israeli regime, all that he wants is to drag the entire region into a regional war. What they care about is that killing more, I'm sorry, but it's been the plan ever since 1948 and long time before 1948, killing more Palestinians, taking over more land. And if only the international community had held those accountable for the killing of children and people and taking over the Palestinian land, if only the international community had held those accountable, held them accountable, and put them to justice, this would have never happened.
Iran's president says crackdown on anti-Israel protests at Western universities has once again exposed the true face of Western civilization and those who claim to be the advocates of freedom of expression. Ebrahim Raisi called the clampdown on protests another chapter of scandal, saying that self-proclaimed defender of freedom of expression are in fact seeking to maintain their dominance. He alluded to the recent beatings and arrests of pro-Palestinian students in the West, especially on US campuses. Raisi said images coming from those universities have also revealed the true nature of the West. Raisi described the protests by university students as an uprising against oppression, crimes, and dominance. He noted that violence against pro-Palestine students won't extinguish the uprising. Students have been turning out across Iran to express support for their Western pro-Palestine counterparts who have been facing a government crackdown. Demonstrations were held in various Iranian universities, including the Persian Gulf University in Bushehr, as well as Urumiya, Lorestan and Kurdistan universities. The protesters also voiced solidarity with the people in Gaza, enduring US-Israeli genocide. Students, faculty members and university staff have been holding demonstrations on US and European campuses in recent days to condemn and call for an end to the atrocities committed against Palestinians in Gaza. They also call for an end to Western government support for Israel. The protesters have been met with a violent response by the police and authorities, including arrests and suspensions. Our correspondent Salman Kujuri has attended a student gathering in the capital, Tehran. There he talked to one of the demonstrators about the motive behind their participation. Let's take a listen.
I'm talking to you from the main gate, in front of the main gate of Tehran University. As you can see, a large group of students, professors and staffers of Tehran University have gathered in yet another large group of protest gatherings here in the Iranian capital. Of course, Tehran University and such a gathering is not just taking place here in front of Tehran University by staffers and students and professors of Tehran University, but also such similar protest gatherings are being held in different universities of Tehran and also different cities all across the country. For example, in Amir Kabir University, also we have Imam Sadegh University, also Shiraz University, Tabriz University. Other similar protest gatherings by Iranian students, staffers, and professors of universities are being held in order to condemn the violent crackdown of U.S. police against American students who are out or they have camped up at the university's campuses to protest, to voice their anger and protest at the way that the U.S. administration is supporting Israel in this ongoing genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip. In order to get more updated and also to see why these students are gathering here, I'm now joined by one of the Iranian students who is among these protesters. Just want to know her viewpoint regarding why she's here. And tell us why you are here attending such protest gathering in front of Tehran University. And what is the main purpose of your participation in this gathering?
Well, tonight we, the students of universities all over Tehran, University of Tehran, the biggest university in Iran, have gathered here to show how we support other students in universities of America, in European countries, and in Australia, who stood up for Palestine and who want their statement to stop the genocide and to stop supporting the Israel, but they're being brutally treated, attacked, suspended, and they're losing their chance to study in the universities they have tried so much for. And want to show that we have heard them and that we do stand with them, we support them, and that what they're doing is making a difference in the world.
Washington has recently passed the Decaptogon Act 2 in order to suffocate the Syrian people and deepen their economic crisis. These sanctions also aim to add pressure on Damascus due to its support for the resistance. But how Syrians see these sanctions? Our correspondent Ibrahim Wadi reports from Damascus.
Syrians have been living in harsh economic conditions for years due to the post-war circumstances. Prices of essential goods like fuel, medicines, bread, and overall goods supplies have seen a soaring trend because of the Western sanctions and over 13 years of war that terrorists waged upon them. Washington has recently passed new sanctions to increase pressure on Damascus by further crippling vital economic sectors, deepening the crisis and starving the Syrian people.
The U.S. and Western countries need a pretext to continue their economic war after the military invasion to overthrow the Syrian state failed. This new act will certainly affect Syrians, but we will continue to defy the United States, which is also targeting Iran, Russia, China, and other countries. Our defiance will lead to Washington's isolation and international failure.
The Decaptogon Act was passed under the pretext of fighting Narcos, oblivious to the fact that the Syrian government was among the initiators of an Arab and regional alliance to combat this issue.
All the pretexts used by the United States in this regard are invalid and legally unsubstantiated. The Syrian government has repeatedly affirmed its readiness to cooperate within a comprehensive international framework to combat the scourge of narcotics and drug trafficking.
The new sanctions leveled against Syria coincide with those imposed on Tehran in the wake of Iran's retaliatory attack on the occupied territories. Some analysts believe these sanctions aim to protect the Israeli regime by distracting the resistance-axis countries from their operations in support of Palestine.
This blind Western strategy is also used against countries like Iran and Russia, especially after their military superiority was demonstrated in Ukraine and recently in the Iranian retaliatory strike against the Zionist entity. But these countries have developed ways to overcome the Western sanctions.
The sanctions have embedded the return of displaced Syrians, significantly hindered construction projects in the country and pushed most Syrians below the poverty line, only due to their commitment to resistance and rejection of normalization with the Israeli regime.
Economic sanctions may serve as a pressure tactic, but they cannot alter the political course, especially when imposed on countries like Syria and Iran, or resistance movements that are ready to make any sacrifices for their causes. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
A Palestinian languishing in Israeli jail, Basim Khandaji, has won the prestigious Arabic Fiction Award at an international competition held in Abu Dhabi. Khandaji's book entitled A Mask, The Color of the Sky, was selected from amongst the 133 works submitted to the 2024 International Prize for Arabic Fiction. The book was published by a Lebanon-based publisher. Khandaji is currently serving 3 life sentences and was jailed for 20 years. He was born in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus and had written many short stories until his arrest in 2004 at the age of 21. Khandaji completed his university degree while in prison and continues to highlight the Palestinian resistance against occupation through his stories and poems. And last but not least, to wrap up the bulletin, the United States and a number of European countries have proposed the confiscation of nearly $300 billion of Russian assets frozen mainly in European banks. Moscow has vowed to give a severe response if its assets are seized. Earlier, we discussed the situation with our guests in our news review program.
Time now for the news review section. Now, Russia has issued a stern warning to the West over a possible seizure of its assets, saying it will give a severe response to the move. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova says that Moscow will pursue endless legal challenges and reciprocal measures if its assets are confiscated by Western countries. She added that Russia would never exchange territories taken back from Ukraine for its frozen assets. The U.S. and its allies have imposed harsh sanctions on Russia's financial sector, resulting in a freezing of nearly $300 billion of its assets in Western banks. Now, let me invite two guests to discuss this. Daniel Patrick Welch is a geopolitical analyst joining me from Boston. Fred Ware is a journalist and political commentator joining me from Moscow. Good to see you, gentlemen, both. Welcome. Now, let me begin with my guest in Boston, Daniel. What is this aimed at, and how seriously could this, in your opinion, impact the war in Ukraine?
Well, like all of the U.S. measures so far, it will have zero impact on the war in Ukraine, and it has zero impetus in that regard. It's not aimed at anyone outside the U.S. body politic. The Americans are so sheltered from the response globally to Israel, to this conflict in Ukraine, to China, that, you know, Anthony Blinken can't even go without being internationally humiliated. They are only concerned about PR. And it looks good. They tried freezing these assets to have a massive effect on the Russian economy and stop them in their tracks. Now the Russians are announcing 3.6% GDP growth for last year. It just is not. It's what it is, is siege warfare. It was always medieval economic siege. And it didn't work. And now they're taking the second step, which is, well, we froze it. So now we're never going to give it back.
Okay. Now, Fred, what's your opinion, and what kind of a response? Because Moscow has said that they would reciprocate this, and they would take countermeasures. What can they do?
Well, at, the moment, not much. There is a huge amount of money, $300 billion, that's been frozen. They're already using the interest payments as windfall profits and giving that to Ukraine. And there are precedents. In the United States did, I believe, seize a lot of Iranian central bank assets at one time, Venezuelan gold reserves. The problem with that, I mean, there are many problems with it, but one is that it undermines the very system that the United States regards as the rules-based international order. You already see a lot of countries pulling their assets out of the United States, out of treasury bills in New York, because they're afraid at some point this kind of Bolshevik style of international governance will hit them. So it is corrosive to the very system the United States claims to uphold, but it also opens Pandora's box, you know, for other countries' claims. Like Germany is fiercely opposed to these measures, this idea of taking Russian assets and giving them to Ukraine, because Germany potentially has a lot of reparations claims that were sort of laid to rest after World War II, but they could still be revived. You know, Poland and Greece are already demanding huge sums from Germany. If you start doing this, there's no end to the financial chaos that will happen in the world. But it's an elegant idea, and it has a lot of supporters. The idea is simple: take that Russian money and give it to Ukraine.
I appreciate your insight and contribution. Daniel Patrick Welch in Boston, Fred Ware in Moscow.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Limelight.
head of the World Health Organization has said the killing of Gaza's children is a stain on all of humanity. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The head of the World Health Organization, WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, has called for an end to the Israeli regime's ongoing genocidal war in Gaza, saying the high number of children casualties in the besieged territory will remain a stain on all of humanity. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, in a post on X on Sunday, 7th of April, said, "The deaths and grievous injuries of thousands of children in Gaza will remain a stain on all of humanity. This assault on present and future generations must end." He also condemned as inhumane and intolerable the denial of basic needs by the Israeli regime, including the cutting off of food, fuel, sanitation, shelter, security, and healthcare, stressing that the fact that over 70% of deaths in Gaza are by women and children and should be a compelling reason for halting the war in Gaza. The World Health Organization chief further noted that the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas's attack against the Israeli regime in early October of last year does not justify the horrific ongoing bombardment and siege by the Israeli regime. He also reiterated his call for peace while vowing to continue to serve healthcare workers, patients, and communities in Gaza. The latest development comes just a week after World Health Organization reported that newborn mortality is rising sharply in Gaza, as the Israeli regime has destroyed the Palestinian territory's healthcare system. The Israeli regime began its genocidal war in Gaza on 7th of October last year, after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas carried out Operation Al-Aqsa Storm against the usurping entity in retaliation for its intensified atrocities against the Palestinian people. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran says the aggression by the United States and Britain against Yemen is a violation of the country's territorial integrity and in line with support for Israel's crimes and atrocities against oppressed Palestinians in Gaza. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a meeting with Mohammad Abdussalam, the senior representative of Yemen's National Salvation Government, in the Omani capital Muscat on Sunday, 7th of April. Hossein Amir Abdollahian praised the brave support of the Yemeni armed forces for the oppressed Palestinian people in the fight against the Israeli regime over the past 6 months. In recent months, the United States and its allies have launched illegal attacks on Yemen amid their frustration in the face of anti-Israel maritime campaign by the Yemeni armed forces. In support of Gaza, the Yemeni armed forces have targeted Israeli ships going to and from ports in the occupied Palestinian territories, or those linked to Israel in the southern Red Sea, in the Bab el-Mandab Strait, in the Gulf of Aden, and even in the Arabian Sea. The US-led attacks on Yemen has prompted the country's military to declare American and British vessels to be legitimate targets. Also, Israeli occupation forces are deliberately targeting Palestinian women in their genocidal war in Gaza, according to a Palestinian minister. The comment was made in a Sunday, 7th of April, press statement by the Palestinian government's Minister of Women's Affairs, Mona Al-Khalili. Al-Khalili noted that 9,560 Palestinian women have been killed by the Israeli military since the beginning of the genocidal campaign in Gaza on 7th of October last year. Women in the Gaza Strip are suffering from the most dangerous and harsh conditions in decades as a result of deteriorating health and living conditions, displacement, and lack of shelter, in addition to the lack of food and water, the Palestinian minister said. Muna al-Khalili stated that there are approximately 15,000 pregnant women currently in the Gaza Strip, 95% of whom do not eat sufficient amounts of this to the mother and the fetus. She added that there are about 1 million forcibly displaced Palestinian women who face exacerbated risks in shelter centers which lack basic facilities. Muna al-Khalili said approximately 37 Palestinian mothers are killed every day in Gaza, leaving behind devastated families and displaced children. In an interview with Press TV on 26th of March, Reem Al-Salem, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women and Girls, said the violence inflicted on Palestinian women and children by the Israeli regime could qualify as acts of genocide under Article 2 of the Genocide Convention. The news agency Agence France-Presse has also covered the same story and tells us more. The United Nations and other international aid organizations on Sunday, 7th of April, decried the devastating toll of 6 months of warfare in Gaza, warning that the Palestinian territory had become beyond catastrophic. 6 months is an awful milestone, the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said, warning that humanity has been all but abandoned in the severity of the conflict in Gaza. The Israeli regime's genocidal offensive in Gaza has killed at least 33,175 Palestinians, many of them women and children, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry in the territory. The World Health Organization chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus made a new condemnation of the barbaric act of violence, thus unleashed the war. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus stressed that the atrocity does not justify the horrific ongoing bombardment, siege and health system demolition by the Israeli regime in Gaza, killing, injuring and starving hundreds of thousands of civilians, including aid workers. Adhanom Ghebreyesus wrote on X, formerly known as Twitter, "The denial of basic needs such as food, fuel, sanitation, shelter, security and healthcare is inhumane and intolerable. Of Gaza's 36 main hospitals, only 10 remain even partially functional, according to the World Health Organization." The WHO chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus voiced particular outrage at the deaths and grievous injuries of thousands of children in Gaza, which he said would remain a stain on all of humanity. "This assault on present and future generations must end," he said. Philip Lazzarini, head of the United Nations agency supporting Palestinian refugees known as UNRWA, said the hellhole in Gaza is deepening by the day. "All lines, including the red lines, were crossed. This war is made far worse through technologies misused by humans to harm other humans en masse." Writing on X, formerly known as Twitter, Philip Lazzarini said, "It is made worse by the famine born from an Israeli-imposed siege on Gaza. One would think it's from a different era. As a result, a man-made famine is eating up bodies of babies and young children." The head of UNICEF, Catherine Russell, said more than 13,000 children have reportedly died in the Palestinian territories. "Homes, schools and hospitals are in ruin. Teachers, doctors and humanitarians killed. Famine is imminent," Catherine Russell, the head of UNICEF, said on X, formerly known as Twitter, on Saturday, 6th of April. The United Nations humanitarian chief Martin Griffiths insisted on Saturday, 6th of April, that there needed to be a reckoning for this betrayal of humanity. The World Health Organization chief, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, pointed out that over 70% of those who have died in Gaza have been women and children. He said, "We urge all parties to silence their guns, and we appeal for peace right now."
WRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Zain. Sayyid Zain, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
All right, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the significance of mental health and how does the religion of Islam and Islamic teachings help us to achieve mental health more in our Islamic life. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Again, I have to ask this question. Give us a definition of mental health. What is it exactly?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, by mental health, I think we here mean a kind of sanitation, which means to protect, or to protect, for example, your mental.
Yes, mentality.
Mentality, or remove, for example, the mental kind of problems that you may suffer. So to keep your mentality pure and clean, you know, and that's why it can be termed a kind of psychological sanitation as well.
Yes.
Yeah, this is what we mean. Not to pollute your mentality with wrong things, for example, with polluted kind of ideas, mentalities, activities, mindsets. These are the things that we can be very much careful.
Yes.
To care about our mentality, to be pure, to be clean, to be pious. Islamically talking, I think taqwa is the most beautiful thing that purify our mentality, you know, because taqwa has different levels. Sometimes taqwa goes to the practical aspect that practically we should control not to do certain things or to do certain things, for example. But the higher level of the taqwa is that that mentally we should be pure.
Yes.
Even not thinking about wrong things, even not imagine. You know, we have to control our imaginary power, not to imagine wrong things. Because first we imagine ma'siyah and then we perform it.
Yes.
So if someone can purify his imagination, his mind, his mental world from the wrong things, so he mentally, Islamically talking, I think mentally he is good, he is okay, he is fine.
Okay, that's right. And so then when we talk about the mental health, we are mainly concerned with our emotional, psychological, and social well-being or wellness in the society. And the we can say, of course, it is not limited only to emotional problems. For example, a couple might have problems between each other because of not benefiting from mental health or mental well-being. And especially in today's world, you know, most of the people, in order to find solutions to their panic attacks or generalized anxiety or we can say emotional problems, major depressive or disorder or something like that, they go and they, for example, use medicine, I mean the pills, tranquilizers or something like that. Do you believe that the religion of Islam and its teaching can help the people to achieve mental health by not referring to, I mean, medicine, medication in cases that are solvable easily in a daily life or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So I definitely think that Islam has answers for these kind of problems. Now, before we get into that, let's just put this out there as well, that there is a place for, you know, it to be a medical issue too, that if it reaches such an extent that, you know, it's a very difficult problem to solve, then medicines do have a role to play as well, right? So we're not denying the role of medicines and medication and it as a medical problem.
Yes.
But I believe in a lot of cases, you know, that are not extreme, they can be first and foremost prevented. If the Islamic lifestyle is lived, if a person applies Islam properly to themselves, these can be prevented. Or even after these kind of mental problems come, they can be sorted out as well through the teachings of Islam.
Yes.
So definitely, I believe Islam has the answer for this. Now, one thing that is, you know, quite important, and inshallah, Sheikh, he can correct me as well, is that Islam looks at the human being in a very different way than how modern medicine or modern, you know, psychology would look at the human being, right? Where we're not just physical beings, right? We're now, yes, our mental health is connected to our physical well-being as well. But more importantly, it's connected to our spiritual well-being. Mm-hmm. That if spiritually we are strong, a lot of these problems we can, you know, avoid them and we can overcome them. Mm-hmm. Things like, you know, depression, anxiety, stress, and all these things, inshallah, you know, they can be helped and protected and, you know, made better with the teachings of Islam.
That's right.
Because Islam looks at the human being at a wholesome level. Mm-hmm. Now, modern medicine, you know, I believe what it tries to do is this, that it has, you know, one way of sorting out these things.
Yes.
That one or two ways, right? Mm-hmm. That they either say that, okay, you do some lifestyle changes,
yes,
some thoughts and all these things.
Yes.
Or they try to put a band-aid on the situation, mm-hmm, and, you know, just give medicines and you know, medicate the person. But it's not a proper, wholesome solution to the problem. Why? Because they're not looking at the human being as a whole.
Okay.
Whereas Islam looks at the human being as a whole,
mm-hmm,
where we do have a physical aspect, a mental, emotional aspect, and also a spiritual, deeper spiritual aspect as
That's
well.
That's all right.
And Sheikh Rouhani, when we talk about the mental health, according to what Sayyid says, you know, schools of thought, you know, I think in psychology, by mentality, we mean the brain. But in Islam, we mean by mental health also means the spiritual diseases too, isn't it?
In Islam, we have the term salim al-nafs.
Uh-huh.
Salamat al-nafs.
Okay.
Salamat al-nafs is the most, we can say, good equivalent for this term that you use.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one who is of salim al-nafs, he is always happy. He is always optimist. He is always prosperous. He enjoys his life. So now the question is that how can we achieve this salamat al-nafs, you know? This is very much important. There are some, from the Quranic perspective and Islamic perspective, there are certain kind of pieces of advice that we can share with our brothers. First of all is iman, faith.
Mm-hmm.
Iman, the true iman according to ayat of the Holy Quran, the one who is with true iman, of course, his nafs is salim.
Mm-hmm.
His ruh is salim, is immune from any kind of, let's say, psychological diseases and problems. And the other one is amal salih, the one who wants to enjoy a kind of salamat al-nafs, he has to fulfill or to do righteous things,
okay,
and good things, amal salih. There are ayat of the Holy Quran that refers to these kind of things. The fourth solution is to be pious, taqwa.
Mm-hmm.
To perform taqwa, to observe taqwa. This is, as we mentioned, the very, very beautiful thing that is even overemphasized in the Holy Quran as well as the riwayat, is to remind yourself of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Dhikrullah ta'ala.
Yes.
You know, what is that beautiful ayah saying that? Allah bi dhikrillah tatma'innu al-qulub.
Yes.
So this itminan al-qalb.
Yes.
Is salamat al-nafs, is the pure and, let's say, the clean nafs is there.
And when you're talking about nafs, you mean both the brain and the soul.
In
isn't
Islam,
it?
In Islamically talking, we have nafs and badan.
Uh-huh.
Ruh and jism.
Okay.
You know?
Yes.
But this is a technical term that is used by the modern kind of psychology.
So brain is a part of the body.
Yeah, brain is a kind of tool, a kind of equipment that is utilized by nafs.
I mean,
it is in the service of nafs.
Okay.
Brain is in the service of nafs.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there is mental world or mentality is also part of nafs.
Mm-hmm.
If it is within the badan, within jism, and of course, nafs is something that controls everything on badan, on jism.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the main part of our existence is soul, nafs, ruh, whatever you term it.
Yes.
So whatever psychological problem, mental problem goes to both, sometimes jism and mainly nafs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why the one who can keep his nafs pure and clean, then of course, automatically his body will be also pure.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what? Because when you solely, I mean, spiritually are pure and clean, then of course you will not let the wrong things comes to you, and also you not let the body to be polluted. That's why you see that in Islam, Islam is the religion of purity,
mm-hmm.
both physical, bodily purity, as well as spiritual purity
one,
or mental purity.
Mental one, that's right.
Why we are always recommended to be always in the status of wudu.
Uh-huh.
You know, a mu'min should be always with wudu.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a very beautiful riwayah, because we do not have time to mention that riwayah, saying that in a beautiful hadith, Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that if a mu'min is in need of wudu,
mm-hmm.
if he makes wudu and then perform this wudu and keep this status of purity,
uh-huh.
and then if he asks something from me, I will absolutely respond and answer his demands. It's a very beautiful hadith.
Very good.
You know? And that is why it says that it encourages Muslim that always be bodily pure.
Bodily pure.
Let alone spiritually.
Spiritually.
So that's why this purity, this tahara that is emphasized a lot in our fiqh, it also relates and refers to mental purity as well. Because when your body is pure, when you always care about your cleanliness,
mm-hmm.
and as the Prophet ﷺ was the most pure and clean and pious person, yeah,
mm-hmm.
in Arab Peninsula, we can say. So that's why these are the point that we should take into consideration from the Islamic perspective, marriage.
Yes.
Marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Because zawj is the khuliqa li taskunu ilayha, is sukoon that we are always,
yes.
men or men and women nowadays,
yes, yes.
are always seeking this sukoon. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
this sukoon is sometimes in good marriage,
mm-hmm.
if you have good spouse, good wife, good husband, and then of course not to be oppressive, and then of course to.
I would get back to some of the other aspects of the mental health. According to Islam and mental beings. And so all in all, when we take a look Islamically at life, I mean, this type of tawhidi or muwahhid type of look, which is very much away from self-centric world or self-centrism in the modern world, automatically brings a kind of calmness and tranquility into right. your lifestyle, because all in all you're looking after is the satisfaction of not yourself or the people around, but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Right. Isn't it, Sayyid?
Yes. So definitely the Tawhidi way of looking at the world, it brings this tranquility, mm-hmm. which the modern way doesn't have. Because okay. in the modern way of looking at the world, it's you versus the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to gain as much as you can for your own benefit, and the modern man is making more and more tools to be able to conquer nature, to take more resources from it, to benefit, to have more pleasure in it. So this idea of me against the world is there in,
yes.
in the modern way of looking at
okay.
at things. Whereas in the Islamic way of looking at things, it's not like that. It's me in the world that is controlled by higher power,
mm-hmm.
right? I'm a part of it. I am not against it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, there is a higher power who is there, who is, you know, taking care of things, right? So when someone believes in this and accepts that there is a unity in the universe,
yes,
right? And there's a system that is there, and, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is there, and does dhikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,
yes.
remembers Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and has, you know, reliance upon Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this automatically brings, you know, calmness.
Calmness.
That I'm worried about, you know, what is going to happen, you know, how will this thing turn out,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you don't believe in a higher power, okay, then, you know, that worry stays there.
Yes.
Then you try to do your best, and, you know, even then, sometimes things don't go well. So there's a stress, there's anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you believe in a higher power, you look at it this way. You say that, I'm going to try my best.
Yes.
Right. But at the end of the day, whatever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants will happen.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, I trust in Him.
Yes.
Right? And that brings calmness and tranquility.
That's right. Okay. Thank you very much for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of mental health and how Islam can help us to achieve better mental health in our Islamic lifestyle. It was very kind of you. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information on this program and other programs, visit our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all and fi amanallah.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept our يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following r/parstoday.en. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
200 days into the Zionist regime's genocidal war, over 34,000 Palestinians were murdered and more than 75,000 were injured. Additionally, approximately 11,000 are missing, trapped under the rubble of their destroyed homes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with residents of the Gaza Strip, including three children, who have been subject to the most horrific genocide for the last 200 days. 200 days into Israel's genocidal war, over 34,000 Palestinians were murdered and more than 75,000 were injured. Additionally, approximately 11,000 are missing, trapped under the rubble of their destroyed homes. Thousands of Palestinians, including youth, children, women, and the elderly, are currently incommunicado. Many believed to be abducted by Israeli occupation forces during its invasion of Gaza. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with residents of the Gaza Strip, including three children, who have been subject to the most horrific genocide for the last 200 days. Haj Abdul Rahman, 83, told the Palestine Chronicle, "I was only 8 years old during the first Palestinian Nakba." He said, "I lived through all the events of the Nakba, the 1967 war, the 1973 war, the first Intifada in 1987, the second Intifada in 2000, and many other major wars. But this one is the deadliest the Palestinian people have ever experienced." He continued, "I lost my grandson, my eldest son, and his family. Me and my wife, we were old and sick. We lacked medication and treatment, and we had to endure the pain of being displaced from our homes." Despite the horrors of the war, many Palestinians are determined to stay in Gaza. It is the case of Abu Muhammad Garman. Garman told the Palestine Chronicle, "The occupation bombed my house, and my brother was murdered. I had already endured the pain of losing my son, Mahmoud, during the 2014 war. But we will remain in our land, and we will not leave." He said, "I lived through the Naxa War in 1967, when the occupation occupied Gaza, Sinai, the Golan Heights, and southern Lebanon, but this war is definitely the harshest. There is no family in Gaza who has been spared from the pain of losing a child, a beloved friend, a close relative. Abu Yazan al-Sadi has lost his friends and neighbors," he said. "On the 198th day of war, the occupation forces bombed the house of our neighbors. The Nowiri family and all those in the building were murdered." Asadi continued, "There is no house in the Gaza Strip that has not been subjected to bombardment. Everyone in Gaza is now sad, afflicted with immense pain. We have lost many loved ones and friends." Children in Gaza are the ones who suffer first and suffer most, according to UNICEF, which deemed Gaza as the most dangerous place in the world to be a child. The Palestine Chronicle spoke with three children who told Palestine Chronicle how their lives changed throughout these 200 days of the Zionist regime's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. Rahaf Hamdan, 12, told the Palestine Chronicle, "I fled with my family from the Boraj camp in central Gaza, and we are now living in an UNRWA school in the Nuseirat refugee camp." She continued, "My life before the war was beautiful, full of joy, but the war changed everything. I hope the war can stop, because now all we feel is fear and terror. There is no fun anymore." 11-year-old Ghazal Awad was displaced with his family from the city of Beit Hanun in the northern Gaza Strip. He said, "My life before the war was very beautiful. We used to go out all the time. We lived in our home. We went to parks. Now our lives have become difficult. We cannot cook, and we live in a shelter. We sleep in a classroom in an UNRWA school." Rahaf al-Hawajiri, 12, was displaced from the village of Johar al-Dik in central Gaza Strip. She said with tears in her eyes, "My life before the war was sweet. I used to play with my friends and go to school every day. But now we are not happy living in displacement schools. The places is not clean, and we don't have our own bathrooms. We sleep on the ground. We are not happy." She continued, I miss my friends, my school, my neighbors, my relatives. We used to play, now we can't play because of the occupation's bombardment. We fear that the army will invade the Nusayrat camp where we are living now.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel has intensified strikes on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, killed over a dozen civilians as a death toll from the regime's genocide tops 34,450. A senior Hamas official stresses that the movement is serious about reaching an agreement on a ceasefire deal in Gaza, but will not yield to any U.S. pressure. And the Iranian president says heavy-handed crackdown on anti-Zionist student protests in Western universities reveals the true nature of Western civilization. Thank you for joining us. Israel has launched fresh air and artillery strikes on various areas of the Gaza Strip, where the situation is nothing less than an absolute cataclysm, targeting several houses in the southern city of Rafah. Elsewhere in the south, 13 bodies were recovered from under the rubble. Air raid on a vehicle killed a civilian and injured two others in the Nusayrat refugee camp. Gaza City also witnessed fresh bombardment, which left a number of civilians dead. According to Gaza's health ministry, 66 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza in the past 24 hours. Israel